Yes.
Oh, hey, Antonio. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you.
Nice to hear your voice.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, my name
is... Yeah, is that David?
Yes.
Hey, David, how are you doing?
I'm well. Can I put you on speakerphone? I think it might actually be better.
Sure. Yeah, we're going to just say hello for a little while, let everyone join us.
Okay.
So just going to give us a couple, keep people a couple of minutes to say hi, and then I'm going to go mute people out.
Okay, great.
So just so everyone knows, you don't have to do anything to mute yourselves out, because I will be doing that for you. We'll start the call in just a few minutes. Is anybody on who would like to say hello before we get started?
Mary.
Mary from?
California.
California. Hey, Mary, how's it going?
Good, how about you?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
You
anybody else on who'd like to say hello?
Hi there, this is Mary Terhune from Boston.
Hey, Mary, how's it going?
Good, thanks.
Good.
Hi, Kim, John from Salt Lake.
Oh, hey, John, how's it going?
Good.
Good.
Hi, Kim, it's Ruth, South Florida.
Oh, hey, Ruth.
Hi.
Hey, Kim, it's Shirley from Colorado.
Oh, hey, Shirley. Hear your voice. Thanks for joining us. Anybody else on who'd like to say hi before we get started?
Hi, Kim, this is Rod from Toledo.
Oh, hey, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good, good. Okay, so I know there's other people on the call, and some of you out there who are a little bit shy and don't want to say hello, but welcome to the call. And we're going to use the same format that we always do on these calls. I'm going to conduct a formal interview for the first 45 or 50 minutes, and then I will unmute the lines and open up the call for questions from people who are participating. So let me go ahead now and mute out the lines and welcome our guest speaker, David Kramer. Hold on 1 second. So, David, can you still hear me? David? Hello? David, can you hear me now? Hello, David? Is everyone else on the phone?
Yeah,
we are.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. David, did we lose you?
Oh, that's embarrassing.
Well, I'm sure he'll come back on in just a moment. So we'll just wait a second. Otherwise, I'll have to ask myself the questions.
Yeah, you'll have to do it all, Kim.
Yeah, I'll have to ask myself the questions and then come up with the right answers. David, did you join us back again yet?
Thought I heard something.
Okay, anybody else would like to say anything before we get started officially here? So I understand that Francis is now hitting Southern Carolina. Has anybody heard about that?
Oh.
Yeah, it's raining a lot.
Yeah, are you on the East Coast?
Yes, I'm in South Carolina.
Oh, you're in South Carolina, yeah. I heard you've got like 8 inches of rain already.
Well, different places, yes. It's raining quite a bit.
Yeah, yeah. David, have you rejoined us?
I have. I'm sorry.
Oh, no problem. Okay, good. So let me go ahead and mute out the line. David, can you still hear me?
Yes, I can.
Fantastic. Okay, so first of all, David, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us for one of our teleconference interviews. It's greatly appreciated by everybody. For those of you who don't know David, let me give him a quick introduction. I consider David to be one of the best homeopaths in North America and also a close personal friend. David's been involved in classical homeopathy and other complementary health therapeutic modalities for over 25 years. He's been a full-time homeopathic consultant for over 15 years, and he's studied homeopathy with many different individuals, including Dr. Francisco Isiaga, Jeremy Scher, Vega Rosenberg. He also attended the 4-year international program that was given by George Vatulkas in Alanisos, Greece. And then subsequently, he was chosen to head up his North American program, which was entitled the International Academy of Classical Homeopathy. David's also the founder and principal lecturer of the Hudson Valley School of Classical Homeopathy, which was established in 1996. And the mission of that school is really to integrate the highest understanding of the principles and theories of classical homeopathy as expounded by the masters and to apply those laws of healing to contemporary life. The intention of the program is to really explore and clarify the total range of emotional and spirituality in the context of the human condition, and to really make the stuff understandable so that we can really have an appropriate understanding of the individual and the cultural context necessary to promote true healing. For those of you who want to contact David, David, can I give out that 845 phone number?
Yes.
Or is there a different number you'd like me to share with you?
The 845 number is fine.
Okay. And so for those of you who might be interested in attending David's program or his school, you can contact that school at 845-255-6141, or you can email him at homeopath4@aol.com. So that's 845-255-6141, and the email again is homeopath4@aol.com. So before we get started, I just wanted to share a quick story about David as a teacher and a practitioner. I've been involved for the last 2.5-3 years now with a project called the Homeopathic Symposium, which is designed to provide very high-quality cured cases and distance learning through the Internet in the field of classical homeopathy. And one of the challenges that the Homeopathic Symposium has been experiencing is being able to collect high-quality cases that meet the criteria we need, you know, 2 or 3 years worth of follow-up and really significantly dramatic improvement in the cases. And so knowing that David was such a good practitioner, I'd heard from so many different individuals about how he had helped them so much in their own with their own personal health situation, that I decided to talk to David about sending a camera person to each of his classes to film the live casework that they were doing there. And we started that a little bit over a year ago, and I spoke to my camera person just last week, and he told me that basically all the cases that were being followed up over that period of a year were all improving dramatically, every single one. In other words, he's batting 1,000% with those cases. And to me, this was just verification of the type of practitioner that David is. I believe he is one of the best prescribers that we have in our community. And so, David, I want to give you just a warm welcome. Thank you again so much for taking the time out to join us, and I know everyone's going to benefit greatly.
Well, Kim, thank you very much, and I think it's a wonderful opportunity to speak to the community. I always enjoy speaking. It's something that my students always accuse me of. But I also want to thank Whole Health now for creating a forum that I think is very, very essential and necessary. And my hat's off to you and Whole Health now for creating this very available forum for everybody to listen in and participate in.
Thanks. I appreciate that. Well, okay, let's go ahead and get started. David, you had an interesting title for the call. It was Nuances in Case-Taking, Creative Repertorization, and the American Psyche. And so I was curious, what do you consider to be the most important aspects in case-taking that a practitioner really needs to bear in mind when he's taking a case?
Well, the most important aspects are always outlined in the organon, but to clarify things, I like to hone in on four essential aspects. And for me, this multidimensional answer has to deal with these four different components. And the first I would say, which is a very obvious thing, is to have respect for your patient. Remember that most of them come because of their disease, but also there's tremendous pressure to seek allopathic treatment, and that's both on a cultural level as well as from family and friends. So the fact that they're in front of you is worthy of respect, that they've overcome those cultural hurdles. The secondly, and this is of utmost importance, is to be prepared in a good way to receive your patient. A good homeopath is one who is really objective, impartial, and free of prejudice toward their patient. And since we don't come naturally to the state of being objective, we have to prepare ourselves for such a state. We need to either meditate or be quiet, just drop all the cares of the day, thinking about shopping, your vacation plans, the great or lousy time you had last night with your significant other, etc., only deflects our attention from the immediate demands of case-taking in the present moment. And third, I think what we have to understand is that we can't hope to cure a case on all levels until we truly understand and see the patient suffering on the physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual level. I think we have to deeply understand the nature of their true suffering only by seeing the complexities of the disease picture in relationship to how it interfaces with all of these four levels. I believe that it's important to note that the presenting symptoms, more often than not, are not the true nature of the disease, but only the superficial manifestation of the vital force manifesting symptoms on the most obvious level for the patient. Our real task is really to reveal the purest and most realistic portrait of the diseased state beyond the presenting symptoms. In a sense, we have to become Sherlock Holmesiopaths. We have to find the truth behind the presenting symptoms, and we have to eradicate them completely. You remember, for example, in The Wizard of Oz, which is a story I like to tell my students, how Dorothy and the Scarecrow, the Cowardly Lion, and the Tin Man can all have their wishes given to them, but they have to kill the Wicked Witch of the West and retrieve her broomstick, which they do, and they kill her with a bucket of water, which is an interesting metaphor in itself. But then Dorothy returns to Emerald City and confronts the wizard and says, here's the broomstick of the Wicked Witch of the West. Now you have to grant us our wishes and so forth. And the wizard says, no, I don't. I'm the wizard. I don't have to do that. And Dorothy says, yes, you do. And she becomes very indignant. Perhaps she needed a dose of causticum at that time. But as they go back and forth, Toto, the little dog, runs to the left side of the stage and draws back the curtain. And you remember, after the curtain is drawn back by Toto, the balloonist is revealed. And the balloonist is actually creating the persona of the wizard. And once the balloonist realizes that he's been revealed, he makes the wizard say about himself, the balloonist, the following line: pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. He is of little or no consequence. And in a way, we have to always pull back the curtain without disturbing the persona. People have worked their entire lives developing a personality and a way of life. Our job is not to interfere, but merely to reveal and to acknowledge what is really the motivating factors in a person's life, but we have to get behind everyone's curtain. So if we're not going to become Sherlock Holmesiopaths, then maybe we can always aim for the level of Toto.
David, that is a wonderful metaphor. I just totally love that. That is just such a lovely image to keep in mind.
Thanks. Just that last part,
yeah,
that I think is important. In order to heal, we must really understand what healing is. And at first, we get the information from the master himself, who writes in paragraph 9. Of the Organon. What I consider to be the most eloquent definition of health, and I'll quote that passage in paragraph 9 of the Organon. He writes, in the healthy human state, the spirit-like force that enlivens the material organism as dynamis governs without restriction and keeps all parts of the organism in admirable, harmonious, vital operation as regards both feelings and functions, so that our reason-gifted, indwelling, rational spirit can freely avail itself of this living, healthy instrument for the purposes of our existence. And for me, this is as close to poetry as you can get in terms of medicine. But you'll notice that Hahnemann doesn't talk about the psoriasis, the falling of the hair, the cancer, or the irritable bowel syndrome. Hahnemann makes it perfectly clear that true health is solely based on getting the patient to a point where both their feelings and their functions are operating well enough so that they can fulfill themselves toward their higher existence. And this is an essential, critical part of understanding healing. And this is indeed a lofty aim, and we have to know a great deal if we can help our patients achieve this end. And it's important to examine these four major points of case-taking in greater depth, but as I said, it's just a general overview here.
Well, you know, those passages you're reading, I mean, I know, David, I've read those hundreds of times. They're so elegant and so beautiful, and there's so much spirituality in them. It's just quite unbelievable. I think people oftentimes miss how spiritual Hahnemann really was, and how much he was really moving in that direction. It's quite amazing.
It is astonishing, and you know, in my school, what I try to do is really bring home the idea of healer, heal thyself, because one reason to have great homage and respect to our patients is they are providing a mirror for us.
Sure.
Every patient somehow reflects for us some of our own dis-ease. Mm. And in that sense, we owe them a tremendous debt of gratitude. And if we can take it, if we can learn from it, we get healthier, perhaps even more than our patients do. And then we're able to treat on a deeper level.
David, why do you think that patients seek out homeopathic treatment? I mean, what do you find brings them into your practice?
Well, I'd like to think it was my devilishly good looks, but I think it has perhaps more to do with the obvious. But they want to be free of their suffering, which is a wonderful thing. Suffering, in a way, is like an appetite. It's what the vital force creates to get our attention. And yet it's the obvious. People come in for their presenting symptoms, but it's usually more a more complex mechanism at work than we generally believe. You know, there's a story of a wise man or a wise woman walking in the mountains, and they come upon a young man or woman in the middle of the road, about 100 yards away, and they're holding the reins of a donkey. And the donkey, it's clear, is not going anywhere. And the owner is yanking and pulling and cursing and spitting and swearing and every which thing. And the donkey's not moving. So the wise person goes up to the owner and says, "Hey, you know, that donkey's carrying all your stuff and you're treating him rather cruelly. If you want him to move with all your stuff in your life, you have to treat him with love and kindness, dignity, respect. You have to nurture him." Well, the owner gets rather upset about this counsel, and as they hand the reins over to the master, they say, "Well, if you're so smart, let's see what you can do." And so they hand the reins over. They walk to one side of the road. The master, well, he or she knows that the donkey's not going anywhere. They put down the reins and walk over to the other side of the road and come back a moment later with a great big fat stick about the size of a baseball bat. And standing smack square in front of the donkey, they haul off and hit him in the head as hard as possible. The owner says, "What the heck are you doing? I thought you had to treat him with love and kindness and dignity and respect, and you had to nurture him." And the wise person says, "Yes, you have to do all those things, but first, you have to get his attention." And that's frequently what the presenting symptoms are, you know, getting the person's attention. Mm. The symptoms, after all, we have to remember, are created by the vital force. And it's usually a state of such magnitude and significance that it interferes with the quality of their lives so dramatically that they can't any longer comfortably coexist with their symptoms. So in my practice, the opera singer gets vocal polyps, and the high society model begins to lose her hair. The writer complains of carpal tunnel syndrome. The culinary editor of a big newspaper becomes allergic to certain foods. The athlete and the dancer, they recover too slowly from the injuries that they sustain. And people who are involved in abusive relationships, well, they develop, lo and behold, arthritic-like tendencies because they just can't move on with their lives. And all these kinds of things fit into a pattern when we see the case, but never is it the case that someone comes into me and tells me that although they've had chronic migraines for a number of years, it's because of a deep emotional trauma they had in childhood. No, they'll always come in for their migraines and their hemorrhoids and their irritable bowel syndrome. But I had a patient many years ago who had migraines for 20 years, and I took her case, and she told me all about the migraines. And then after I finished taking the initial presenting symptoms, I said, "Well, did anything happen 20 years ago?" And she said, "Well, as a matter of fact, I've been married for 20 years. And I said, "Aha, etiology." And I said, "Well, how did you feel about your husband when you got married?" And she said, "Oh, I loved him tremendously and dearly." And I said, "Well, what happened? How do you feel about your husband now?" My thinking was that the relationship deteriorated quickly. And she said, "I love him now more than I loved him then." And my jaw dropped. And I said, "Well, are you sure?" She said, "Absolutely." I said, did anything else happen? She said, well, I started a job. I said, uh-huh. How did you feel about your job? I love my work. I said, how do you feel about your coworkers? I love the people I work with. I said, is there anything about the job you don't like? And her face turned nasty and mean, and she said, I hate my boss. I said, why? She said, he treats me like I'm just a piece of garbage, and he's the biggest male chauvinist pig this side of the Rockies. I said, and when did your headache start, before or after this job? She said, interesting that you should mention that. It started just after I started working. She said, I get no respect from him. I've never gotten respect for him, and he's all-powerful, and I just leave him trembling. So between the migraine symptoms that I took and the trembling from her boss, of course, I gave her a dose of staff to save her. And 6 weeks later, she came in for the regular follow-up. I said, how are your headaches? She said, well, you know, they're okay. They're about 20% better. I said, well, that's movement, and I'm hopeful with that kind of movement after 6 weeks. And so I said, well, continue on the prescription and the administration that I gave you and come back in another 6 weeks. And 6 weeks later, she came back, and I said, well, how are your headaches? And I'm expecting to hear maybe 30-35% improved. And she said, they're all gone. I said, really? Because we don't want to hear that its symptoms go away immediately, because that's really not according to the laws of nature. Things don't happen suddenly. It often indicates a terminal case. So I said, are you sure they're all gone? They're not just there a little bit? She said, no, I haven't had a headache for weeks. I said, why is that? She said, well, my boss said, hey, sweetie, get me a cup of coffee. So I got him a cup of coffee. And then I spilled it right in his lap. I said, drink it yourself, pig. And I walked out and quit my job. Haven't had a headache since.
That's a great story, David.
and that's what a really healthy person does. They're willing to put aside their material gain, the investment financially, their history, in order to become really healthy. And that's what we have to look for. So in my job then, people come to me, people come to you, to other homeopaths, but we have to hear them, we have to see them, we have to ascertain why they have their problems and allow them to discover for themselves what the obstacles are in their lives and how to overcome them. And of course, it's absolutely absurd to ascribe all the complaints to this idea alone. And yet it occurs more frequently than not. We need to observe the case in the complete totality and the context of the patient's life. That's why people come to me, because I'm a Sherlock Holmesiopath. I look where other people dare not go.
David, you mentioned the you emphasized the ability to genuinely see the patient. Can you give us a general idea of what you mean by that and maybe some specific examples?
Sure. To really see the patient, for me, is the most important tool we have at our disposal. It helps us the most in our case-taking, and it's a tool that we can continuously hone. In fact, the title of my course, of my school, is The Art of Seeing in Case-Taking in Homeopathy. As you know, as Hahnemann says, the unprejudiced observer must perceive with all of his or her senses. And it's interesting, as precise as Hahnemann was, he doesn't limit our senses to the five obvious ones. And it's my sense that he's hinting at more than just the ordinary, but that I believe he's referring or pointing to a level of objective consciousness that perhaps is another sense and something that we're not born with, but that we can develop. So, for example, when I greet a patient and shake their hand, I've already started taking the case. The way that they drive into the parking area, for example, or park the car. In fact, you know, if you stretch the point, the NUX patient will drive in very quickly, pick the closest spot to the door, and take up more room than is necessary. At the interview with the patient, what is the patient's tone of voice? What kind of language do they use? When do they pause or answer direct questions? What are their facial expressions while answering, their body posture, their enthusiasm or the lack thereof, their eye contact, their emotional and tonal responses when talking about very seemingly important emotional issues? You should notice their eye movements, their hesitations, body tension, hand activity. There are just dozens of things to observe, and remember that all those manifestations are a direct, not an indirect, but a direct representation and manifestation of the pathology. If you miss those, then you're missing the case as it actually exists on real time as the person is in front of you. Additionally, I believe you have to learn about the person's modus operandi, their MO, if you will, their motivation for doing anything. And this will tell you exactly what makes them tick, their hobbies, the nature of their social relationships, how their relationships work or how they ended or who ended them and for what reasons. And what the kind of music they like may actually be as telling in a case as their cravings and aversions for food. But there is a real danger, and I emphasize to my students, there's absolutely, positively no room whatsoever. Is that unclear, that emphatic statement?
I think you made that clear.
Okay. For speculation about the arising of these manifestations and these symptoms as it pertains to the patient. I mean, if they exist within the entire framework of the person's life, then there is a relevance to the case. But if it's not born out of the patient's actual empirical experience, any conclusions and assessments that are drawn regarding the patient, those major obstacles in life and the subsequent treatment is really nothing more than utter nonsense and fantasy. And quite frankly, much to my dismay, there has been far too much of these airy-fairy case analyses by those pretending that their intuition alone about a case is sufficient to prescribe, because I've treated dozens and dozens and dozens of individuals who have gone to certain homeopaths who profess certain capabilities, and I have to tell you, I haven't met one that has benefited from that treatment, although I'm not saying it's not a possibility. It's not my experience in the last 18 years that one has really given a definitive benefit to the patient that they were treating.
I have a similar experience, David, just so you know.
Personally or professionally?
Yeah, well, professionally, when I travel around, a lot of the things that aren't really grounded in an inductive approach and that don't really follow, you know, the principles of the organon, I find usually are not consistently effective. So I've had a comparable type of experience.
Well, I'm sorry that you've had the experience, but I'm glad to be reinforced by your experience. In the homeopathic community, you have a greater experience than myself, but I think it's unfortunate in a way, and it goes to the American pathology, and we'll discuss this later on, about people who just don't want to really work hard. Hahnemann says homeopathy is hard work. I'd like to sit back and do an eeny, miny, mo kind of repertorization and pick a remedy out of a rubric, but in my experience, it hasn't worked. And I think we need to be clear that if you're going to take on the responsibility for someone's well-being, it has to be a very, very serious endeavor.
David, I've heard you mention in the past this thing called creative repertorization. Can you give us some illustrations of that in cases that you've solved, maybe an example of acute and a chronic disease case?
Well, sure. You know, the repertory is a great tool, and I have to say that for half of my professional career, I was a very adept page flipper, going from one text to another, one repertory to another. In fact, I have a huge desk, and I had it stacked with all kinds of books. But ever since I got my radar program, I am one happy camper. It has helped me tremendously. But you still, it's still a computer, still only works depending on what you put in it.
Sure.
But it is really a tremendous asset. But the repertory is a great tool, but all few two people, it seems interesting. Most homeopaths I know politically are center or liberal, but when it comes to repertorization, they're hardcore fundamentalists. And people don't know how to use it artistically or creatively. So I don't think it's used correctly or efficiently. There are hundreds of provings since the time of Hahnemann and Kent. In fact, in the early 20th century, you know, Kent created his repertory, and it only has 100 pages in the mind section. But today's repertories have nearly four times as much, and I wonder, can it be that the human mental and emotional experience has increased so dramatically in 85 years, and my feeling is that it hasn't. And while new rubrics have been added, which sort of bulk up the pages, it's not that much. But what I am convinced of is that we have improved our technology, but we haven't improved our understanding so dramatically, so that these new rubrics would have such clarity that they would alone profoundly enhance our understanding of the human condition and the patients we're working with. Well, firstly, before going to the repertory, I think we have to understand our patients. What is the thing that motivates them? What gets them out of bed? What is their behavior and their manifestation? It's not just the intensity of the events in their lives as to how the symptoms will appear in the near or the long run, but rather it's how the patient has personally internalized that kind of impression, and how and in what manner each center is affected by that impression. So, for example, a number of years ago in New York, there was a big trial of a woman who worked in a major stock brokerage house of fame, and she had a lawsuit against the firm because some obnoxious middle management guy made some chauvinist remark in the copy room. It wasn't long, he didn't touch her, and she sued because it traumatized her so much that she had to leave work, get psychiatric help, she was hospitalized, and she won the case and won nearly $1 million. And at the same time, I have patients who have been physically sexually abused for many years in their childhood. And unfortunately, we live in a culture where I believe at least 30% of all women in this country have been physically, sexually abused before the age of 18. But I've had women who have had these horrific, horrific experiences and have seen them as terrible, but have not internalized them such that it has traumatized their whole life. So here you have a case of a woman who hears a certain phrase and she becomes disabled, and other women who have horrific experiences and seem to move on, still acknowledging the experience as being quite tragic and horrible. And I'm not saying this woman who heard the phrase herself had not, I mean, I don't know anything about her. It may have been the straw that broke the camel's back. But in all cases, we need to see how people internalize their pathology. So, or the impressions that then create pathology. And so I have a few cases that I'd like to share with people on the lines. And one was not so long ago, 2 years ago in the wintertime, a six-year-old child, the mother called up at about 10 o'clock at night. I live in upstate New York, and the child lived in New York City, so at 10 o'clock at night there was no way for the child to come up here. And the mother calls and says the child has a terrible earache, and of course you can hear the child screaming in the background. And I did a repertorization, and I came down with five remedies. And I couldn't get any more information. I was just stuck. I mean, there was no modalities, no rare and peculiar symptoms, nothing that would differentiate one remedy from another. And I said to the mother, has there been any departure in your child's behavior about anything in her life recently. And she said, funny you should mention that. You know, for the last 2 days before the earaches came on, she's been asking about play dates. And while my child is pretty friendly, she's not an extrovert, and she's never really asked for play dates in the past, although she's gone on them, but she's never initiated them. But for the last 2 days, she's been doing nothing but asking me about the play dates. I said, so that's a real departure from her norm. She said, absolutely, I can't understand it. And so I repertorized, and I gave her Nux Vomica. And the reason that I gave her Nux Vomica was because the rubric that I used was anxiety about business. And the business of a six-year-old child is to play. So, of course, she's going to ask about play dates, which is a departure from her norm. And the mother had, fortunately, a remedy kit at home. It had Nux in it. She called back 15 minutes later after I hung up the phone and said, 2 minutes after the child took the remedy, the crying stopped. 5 minutes later, she was in bed. 3 minutes later, she was asleep, and she's just sleeping as comfortably as possible. So that's one acute case. A chronic case is a woman who is very anxious about her life, restless. She's always meddling in people's business, but the people think it's in a very nice way. But she has to busy herself in their lives constantly. But she could never relax, never relax. And every time she was sitting down in a chair when her husband came in, she would say, well, you know, I just a second sit down, honey. I really did. I've been busy all day. And her husband said, it's okay, just relax. She said, no, I just a second sit down. I promise you, I clean the house. He said, I know you do all those things. Just relax. She said, no, I just this minute sat down. She would never let her friends see her relaxed. And after a couple of years of treating her, after all her physical complaints were ameliorated, including a very serious physical health problem, we focused more on this, and she said, you know, I feel like I'm a drug addict that's got to sneak around just to get some relaxation. And I don't know why, because nobody makes me feel bad, but I feel just like an addict. So I gave her sulfur. And the rubric that I used was, under the mind section, which was under alcoholism, and the sub-rubric is drinking on the sly. And so in this case, within about 2 or 3 weeks, she's pretty much slowed down from so much meddlesome involvement in other people's affairs. And this has gone on now for the last 6 or 8 months. So it seems fairly healthy and a good direction because I've kept increasing the sulfur, and as the sulfur goes higher, her meddlesomeness diminishes. So it seems like a good proportion.
Very interesting.
David, you know, sometimes in the repertory we have a difficulty in that we have two rubrics that have kind of the same meaning, like, you know, liar, dishonest, deceitful, and untruthful. You know, they all kind of have the same meaning, and yet they don't have the same remedies in them. How do you deal with that situation? Or how do you distinguish between rubrics that seem equally pertinent to a case?
Well, that's a good question. I think it's problematic for a lot of prescribers. You know, how do you deal with the distinction between anxiety and anxiousness? Or anxiety, anxiousness, and anguish? And so my feeling is it all depends on how the patient presents the pathology in relation to themselves, how they process it, assimilate it, and eliminate it. You know, has the patient, for example, become sensitized to a certain center such that if you just look at them in an odd way, they'll take great offense at it, whereas another person would just slough it off and say, you know, it's nothing. But before looking at the remedies and seeing which remedies come up, what I recommend is that we make sure we understand the thread of the case. Let's understand how the patient internalizes the information. Let's make certain also that we always fit the patient to the remedy and never the other way around, the remedy to the patient. Should always try to find the strange, rare, and peculiar symptoms of a case, even though they may not be obvious, and they may be present themselves in the person's overall demeanor and not really in any specific symptoms. And lastly, never project or speculate or superimpose your own subjective experiences on the patient, because someone may tell you a story and you'll think of something that happened in your life and you'll start to cry, and the patient said, well, it wasn't so bad. Can I get you a tissue? We'll be able to match better if we allow the patient to be as they are without projecting anything onto them and see whether their anguish is really anguish for them, and not comparing them to anyone else, but only seeing how it affects themselves.
David, when you're working on a repertorization for a case, do you focus more on the presenting symptoms, the physical symptoms, the emotional, mental symptoms? Where is your area of focus primarily?
Well, again, you know, my main emphasis is to understand the patient as a whole, you know, like a flower. You know, there are the different parts of the flower, but the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. And I have an axiom that I've developed over the years, and it's basically the idea that disease will manifest on all centers of the organism and produce symptoms on the physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual plane in such a way that each center will be equally represented, but only to the degree to which it has already assumed pathology. And that we have to take into account, which is the background in terms of miasmatic predisposition, personality type, allopathic treatment, and other factors. But it all comes down to the bottom line that a great wise person once said, when it rains, everything gets wet. But it all depends on how it receives the moisture. So for the person that suffers, let's say, from chronic constipation, searches for words while speaking, has fixed ideas, is obstinate, irritable, irresolute, has religious mania, you might think of a constriction. And that would be correct. There is the threat of constriction. But it's important to be, as Hahnemann says, free of our prejudices, and not immediately jump to a snake remedy. The current thought is that, you know, remedies that have signatures seem to be the most valid remedies. And I don't necessarily agree with that, because while laccasis is present in that repertorization, so is aluminum, anacardium, calcarea carbonica, natmure, nux, sorinum, silica, sulfur, and thuja. So we've got a wide spread there. And all those remedies, we don't think of constrictive remedies. But we need to see the threat of constriction and drop the prejudice. Now, laccasis, as you take the case, may indeed come up. But don't leave the case with the obvious. Like I say, if we're Sherlock Holmesiopaths, we have to find the clue that other people have missed. Those are the ones who stopped and gave laccasis and laccasis. And maybe there was a temporary amelioration, but not a genuine cure. So I always start repertorization with the presenting symptoms first as a sign of respect for the patient, because that's the reason that they're there in the first case, and it's a good beginning anyway. And then I spread out to understanding all the different parts, emotionally, mentally, spiritually, of the rest of the patient, and then I take a look at them as a whole. And then I start my repertorization.
David, I heard you mention this term. I believe it's a term that you coined called default adaptability. Is that the correct term?
That's correct.
Default. Could you tell us a little bit about how that applies to classical homeopathy?
You know, George Van Holkes, in the course that I took with him some years ago, it was a four-year program, he mentioned on more than one occasion that Americans are incapable of having epidemics. And the reason for that is that the pathology has gone so deeply into the American psyche that it could only affect them emotionally, mentally, and spiritually, but not have very much impact on their physical body. And I think there's much to be thought of with regard to that. And, you know, if we examine the fundamental components of individual in Western technocratic society, that would be, you know, family, work, community, relaxation, free time, eating, sleeping, sexual relations, etc., we observe that the natural desire for complete fulfillment in human beings is really seriously lacking here in most areas. And while it's accurate to say that we are an adaptable species and that real health might be defined as adaptability, it has to be understood within certain acceptable levels of the general overall health of the individual as well as the culture. We need to understand that in this culture, having traveled around the world a lot and seen this wonderful planet, I have to say America is one of the most beautiful countries in this whole planet. But also we have, as they say, the other end of the stick. We have huge numbers of our population on drugs, whether recreational or prescribed drugs. We have the highest rate of suicides amongst teenagers and children, many, many things. I'm sure everyone listening out there has a plethora of material that they could turn to support that. But what we're lacking is a level of functionality that Hahnemann himself defined as the optimal state of health, which is the desire to achieve fulfillment of our higher purpose. And that's almost absent in this culture. So consequently, we settle for something less than wanting to be fulfilling our higher purpose. And we now live inharmonious existence, and the reflection of that inharmonious existence is the way we conduct our lives. And in a way, by default, we have given up our birthright, if you will, to live our higher existences and sort of live a life that is not as high as it could be, nor as a culture do we know that it could exist. And that state of living is what I call default adaptability. That is, we have become accustomed to living at a certain level, and that level becomes the norm. But that level is not nearly what it could be for the fulfillment of the human potential. And we need to see that this default adaptability is the same mechanism of the innate intelligence of the vital force that operates when a healthy person loses a leg or some sense or function, and the body tries to accommodate and make adjustments. And if the body can accommodate, the person can then live a fairly, quote-unquote, normal life. However, when a person psychologically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually is not in a healthy state and has already created their creative needs, suppressed their creative needs, and compromised on loving and nurturing and spiritual evolution, then by default they adapt to their non-harmonious lifestyle. But in a way, this leads to further repression of genuine needs, and ultimately, I see it resulting in chronic diseases on all levels. And the consequences of the default adaptability creates dis-ease on the physical, mental, emotional plane, and here we see the desire for fun, for investment in entertainment, and life-exhilarating experiences, and so forth, sporting events, recreational drugs, alcohol, promiscuity, pornography, which is, by the way, the single most sought-after websites in the United States is pornography. So we live in a society that becomes competitive rather than cooperative, and as T.S. Eliot wrote more than 50 years ago in a poem called J. Alfred Prufrock, he writes that people live lives of quiet desperation. And I think in a way that sums up many of the people who we get. So we are then the embodiment of the age of technology. So we have the ability to do, but without a healthy range of emotions or spiritual pursuits in order to fulfill something. So we end up doing rather than being. So that would be a working definition for default adaptability.
Fascinating, David. David, you know, I heard a story, maybe you can confirm if this is correct or not, that and I think there's a few different practitioners who had this type of experience, because I know you've worked with George very closely, that when they would visit George in Greece, he would have tremendous success in his practice, but that when he came to Europe or came to North America, he went to the Western world or Western civilization, I mean, of course, Greece is part of Western civilization, but, you know what we call the industrialized society, that he wasn't able to achieve the same level of success. Do you know about this, or have you heard about this?
Yes, I'd have to agree with that. I mean, George is a great homeopath, and fortunately for him, he cut his teeth on people who were relatively pure in their way. They weren't vaccinated, they didn't have a lot of drugs, they didn't suppress a lot of stuff, and so on and so forth. They lived lifestyles that their parents and forefathers lived, so things were pretty direct and clear. And what he found is that we're all bungled up, as it were, and he had difficulty untangling the fishing line, as it were. And it became a bit problematic. You know, when I was in Greece, I took the case of the woman who I rented my room from, and I had an interpreter. She spoke Greek, and obviously I spoke English. And so I came up with what I thought was a remedy, and so I asked a confirmatory question. I said, "How do you feel about eating fat on meat?" And a big smile came over her face, and the interpreter interpreted the following. She said, "I love fat. I give my meat to my children, and I take the fat all for myself. It's my favorite thing in the world." And I ask you, can you hear an American saying that? Just give me fat. Forget about the meat.
Yeah.
So, you see, in a way, it's a really hard thing to have clarity, and that's one of the obstacles that we're faced, is people just being clear about what is genuinely their own and not anymore. People have acquired so many mental states about how they think they should live their lives rather than living their lives directly.
David, so, I mean, this is obviously a problem for us as American practitioners. What can you maybe just very quickly tell us, what are some of the major obstacles that you've seen for being effectively able to treat American patients, and or just to get rid of this, that, you know, the acquired alienated technological mindset that we've got? Is there certain things that you've found that are very important to address?
Well, I think the main thing is to bring the patient to the point that they can understand, like the woman with the headaches, that there's an obstacle in her life and she has to remove it under any circumstance, even if it means quitting her job. And that takes a long time, but many patients are willing to do that. And another obstacle, very simply, is getting patients to get rid of the notion that they are powerless, because people will come to me, and I spend a lot of time just educating them on what healing is and what homeopathy is, and I give them papers and handouts and leaflets and so on and so forth. And at the first sign of an aggravation, they'll report in, and they took this medication over the counter, and they went to the doctor, and they suppressed it with that medication. And the ones who come to me with the biggest smiles are the ones who go to the health food stores and get more homeopathic remedies and take a whole bunch of them. And so education and informing people that they have power and that there is a lawfulness to healing, that it's not an arbitrary law, that there is no immediate gratification, that the results are permanent and life-enduring, but they have to follow the lawfulness of nature, and part of the American pathology is immediate gratification. So these are some of the many obstacles that we have.
So, you know, David, we're kind of running out of time here.
Sure.
But I did want to ask you one more question, and it's relative to what we're talking about. And, you know, Hahnemann advocates in the Organon that, you know, that we try to bring about a quick, rapid, gentle, and permanent cure to our patients. And with what you're saying here, it seems that this is, especially in the American culture, the alienated technological mind culture, that this is much more difficult. Do you think there's hope? Can we do this? Can we bring about a quick, gentle, permanent cure in our patients, or are we kidding ourselves and we're better off just trying to palliate the presenting symptoms or give them some type of temporary relief? I mean, what is your feeling about this?
My feeling is don't give up. The ones who can benefit most from it will stay with it, work with it, recommend their friends. While there's four times as many rubrics in the repertory as there were 85 years ago, I believe in the good nature of humanity. And so there are enough people who will follow the course and become evolved and educated and informed, and they won't be all your patients, and you shouldn't take it personally when some of them leave, but the ones who stay will promote homeopathy and most importantly, live a really good life for themselves. And my greatest joy now, after doing this for 18 years or so, is I'm now treating the children of patients who were children of mine 18 years ago. And they don't vaccinate their children, and they don't run to the doctors for earaches and so on and so forth. And it's an evolution. It's slow, but it's an evolution, and I'm very hopeful.
Well, I know you have a lot to be hopeful about, because I know that you're in your own practice, David, you're getting a very high success rate. I mentioned that story of Gregory Pace going out to your school and filming you for the last year. But also, I know I've heard from many, many different people that they've all been cured by you. So I know that you're doing something right. And, it's so obvious from this interview that you have so much to share with aspiring students and practitioners of homeopathy. I can't tell you what a wonderful call this has been. I'm just think it was just absolutely fantastic and full of useful information. So I want to thank you again before I unmute the call and open it up to the general audience. But, David, that was just a fabulous call. Thank you so much for that.
Tim, it's certainly my pleasure.
Okay. All right, so I'm going to go ahead and unmute the lines and open it up to the general audience. And we have time for a few questions here, so let's go ahead and do that.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
Do you have a website we can look at?
Yes, I do. It's in the process of being worked. I was hoping to work it out and get it up today, but the website is classicalhomeopathy.com. Should be up in the air, so
So, David, that's www.classicalhomeopathy.com. Is that correct?
Yes, classical homeopathy is one word.
One word, all lowercase, www.classicalhomeopathy.com. Okay, good.
Right.
Other questions?
Could you repeat the rest of the contact information, please, the phone number? And
yes, I'd be happy to do that. So the phone number, again, for reaching David's school is 845-255-6141. 845-255. I'm sorry?
And the name of the school, please?
David, the name of your school is?
Hudson Valley School of Classical Homeopathy.
There you go.
What was that? I'm sorry?
The Hudson Valley School of Classical Homeopathy.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you for listening.
Okay, well, one or two more questions?
David, where's your New York accent?
From the Bronx.
Okay.
You must be a fantastic homeopath to have picked that up.
Okay, one more question? Anybody? You got a master homeopath?
I have one, David.
Yes?
You said preparing for the client, preparing yourself to receive them. You talk about meditation and things like that.
Yes, I do.
One of the problems I have is this trying to not enter or feel the things that have happened to me that they're saying. I work on it all the time, but it seems like I spend a little energy doing it, and I'm wondering if there's a easier way other than just maybe keep trying.
Well, I would suggest you just keep trying. I mean, we all have a lot of experiences in life. Many of them have not been pleasant. And we need to, you know, if we come from the understanding that here is someone who's asking for our help and we need to put our own personal issues aside, because in paragraph one, Hahnemann pretty much states it all. It's our high and only mission. And if we attend to that and have that kind of mindset, it's not as difficult to just try to work in that, walk into that office and greet the person, say hi, and feel inside, I am a healer. They wish to be healed. Let me use the tools that I know how to use best. And then after they're left, after they leave, then get out the tissues and cry your eyes out if you like. That's great.
That's great. Great answer, David. Okay, so, David, thank you so much again. Did somebody have one final question?
I just have a quick one.
Go ahead.
Wondering if there's any workshops at all that you might do?
Well, I have my school that's in upstate New York, about 100 miles north of New York City, and if you call or contact us, we'll be glad to send you information. Occasionally, I travel around, give some workshops, and you can contact me at the number or website or email that's been provided.
Thank you.
Hopefully, we'll get David to join us for another one of these calls in the future, and perhaps we can even sponsor an event someplace in the United States. He's such a talented prescriber, I think that really almost anybody can learn from him. So I think that we'll look into doing that for the near future. So can everyone give David a big thank you for joining us on the call today?
Thank you so much. It was very informative, very interesting.
Thanks, David.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, David.
Keep you, David.
Thank you.
Hello?
Bill's Pizza, pepperoni or anchovies? Tim, are you there? No. Okay. Oh. Goodbye and God bless you all.
Hello? Hey, who's there?
David Kramer, who's this?
Dave Kramer? Oh, sorry. Wrong number.
Okay.